Hello, and welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast, Ancient Asides Edition. My name is Coyle Neal. I am Assistant Professor of Political Science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. Joining me today is Jordan Poss, Adjunct Instructor of History at Greenville Technical College in Greenville, South Carolina. Jordan, how are things going today?
Great. As we were talking about before we started recording, I have no idea when this will drop, but we're recording on Cow Appreciation Day. Which, if you don't know what that means, you need to hie thee southward as quickly as possible. Got up, dressed the baby in spots and cow ears, and went out for some free breakfast at Chick-fil-A. So my day is off to a great start.
So because you were eating breakfast at Chick-fil-A, I can assume certain political things about you, right?
correlation, not causation, but yeah.
if I were a liberal, which business should I hate more, Hobby Lobby or Chick-fil-A?
Oh man, you know that mindset of just proscribing certain businesses for arcane reasons is so foreign to me. I don't know that I could tell you.
But only the bad businesses, like the good businesses that agree with the things I agree with. You know,
like Ben and Jerry's.
Right. Or Bruce Springsteen's company for boycotting North Carolina, or, you know, of course, all of this by the time this post will be so dated, no one.
Oh yeah, totally. Well, we were talking about the Confederate flag before before we started recording too, which, you know, everybody's already forgotten. Right. Well, I guess it depends on what your priorities are, but Hobby Lobby did sue over, Obamacare, where Chick-fil-A has just been quietly selling delicious chicken.
Right. Well, Hobby Lobby sued and won, so, you know, double whammy.
Right. So, you might, if you want a high-profile target, if you want to take down the visible guy, it would be Chick-fil-A. But the one maybe doing real damage might be Hobby Lobby.
Maybe I'll ask Ed this question the next time we record. that'll give you some idea of when we're recording these relative to each other.
Well, whose bathroom do you use at Chick-fil-A, I guess?
Whichever one I want to.
If you're, as long as you're not in North Carolina.
Well, pending a court decision, I suppose. which again, by the time this posts, we may have.
Topical.
In which case, I suspect it'll be whichever one I want to.
Yeah. One more thing. I was at a used bookstore the other day and had to step into the restroom. And as soon as I stepped out of the men's restroom, a woman just like, without any hesitation, walked in right in after me and shut the door. And I texted my wife jokingly and just said, you know, all this bathroom stuff is like completely upended the social fabric.
right.
Dogs and cats living together.
8 years of Obama and we no longer know which bathroom to use.
oh, boy.
Moving aside from potty humor, we do have a correction to make, and Jordan,
yes.
you want me to make that, or do you want?
Oh no, I'm glad to do it. I just very briefly, I've just been deeply annoyed with myself ever since we last recorded. Right at the end of the episode, I recommended checking out translations of Cicero by Michael Alexander. If you go looking for those, you are going to come up sorely disappointed. Michael Alexander does translations for Penguin Classics, but he translates things like Beowulf and the Battle of Maldon. This is a case of my interests kind of cross-pollinating in my fevered brain. The Michael that you're looking for, who translated not just Cicero but also Tacitus, and he's also done some work on Suetonius, is Michael Grant. That's who I was trying to refer to, and goofed, so mea culpa.
Right, and I think as far as book recommendations go, basically everything we've been talking about Rome so far, Michael Grant has something on. Right?
Yeah,
and there's he is. I don't know that there is a topic or time period in Roman history when Michael Grant has not written about it.
Right. Yeah, as I was saying last time.
Just a phenomenal writer in terms of his output.
Right. Oh yeah, he's the Stephen King of ancient history. That's what I was trying to say last time too, is that, especially in like the 70s and 80s when he was kind of at his height, I was digging through some boxes of ancient history books recently. And I mean, he's got a book on the end of the Roman Republic, the Roman army, the imperial, the early empire, the late empire, the Republic, the Jewish revolt, the, you know, Jews in ancient history. He's got stuff on Greece. You won't read far in this period without running across Michael Grant, and I'm amazed that I goofed up his name.
Right, which is interesting because I've had professors, and I will leave that vague as to what they taught or who they were, who really did not like him. They tended to assume that he only wrote popular level stuff because he wrote so much.
Right.
That's not been my impression on reading his books. Yes, it is easy to read, but it's, you know, well researched. You know, some of it's written in the 70s, so it's, you know, the research at this point is 40 years old, but easy to read, but still well documented, well footnoted, and even where it's wrong, it's understandable. It's not like he's just coming up with stuff.
Yeah, and he, I think just because of the time he was writing in, I mean, the vogue at that time prior to the fall of the Berlin Wall was sort of economic explanations for everything. So if I disagree with him in any great extent, it's just the heavy emphasis he lays on economic determinism. But yeah, I would agree with everything else you said. It's, you know, quality stuff.
Well, with our infomercial for Michael Grant ended, which is an infomercial I'm happy to provide. He's a great scholar, a great writer. We should move into our subject. So last time we left off with the death of Augustus and the problem of succession, which is a problem that never goes away in the Roman Empire all the way through the end. And even to some extent in the Byzantine Empire, you have this issue of who takes over when the old emperor dies. Because they are so reluctant to say that this is a king, you can't formally have a father-to-son relationship, right? You have to have some kind of apparatus for picking the ruler, but it's not a formal office, at least at the beginning. So how do you pick someone to fill an informal office in what is functionally a monarchy, but on paper still a republic? Well, you can't use the republican institutions. You can't use the assemblies. You can't use the Senate. In fact, the assemblies die off fairly quickly after Augustus dies. They don't outlive him by much. Tiberius does a lot of work to killing those, which we'll see in a second. So Augustus picks several successors. They all die before he does because he lives to such extreme old age. Finally, the story is he says, let Tiberius rule. Tiberius had been serving as, I think, a minor governor up in Germany, up on the border, doing, by all accounts, a very good job. He's an interesting guy, and the sources gets mistreated a little bit, but maybe that's not unfair. It does sound like he's sort of a dour old fuddy-duddy, and that as much as he wanted to be emperor, once he was there, he really didn't like it. And maybe that tells us something about him, namely that he probably did care about doing a good job, but just found it a really hard job to do. We'll see in a few minutes some emperors who don't care about doing a good job and they just have a blast in the office. So, your attitude does affect a lot of this. So Tiberius, Jordan, anything you want to say about this guy? I mean, his big thing is he takes over after Augustus, and by comparison doesn't look like he's doing a very good job. I think that's sort of the big point of his reign. Not that he's a bad emperor, just he's following, you know, one of the best they ever have.
Right. Yeah, he's, this is maybe unfair to both parties, but he's maybe the Gerald Ford of the Julio-Claudians. there's nothing particularly wrong with him, but he's not particularly a shining example of what the office of the princeps can be. Personality-wise, you're right. I think he's described in Suetonius as being kind of dour and having sort of a dark look on his face all the time, which I sympathize with. I've got what I call angry eyebrows, which, you know, suggests that people at parties stay away from me.
Well, you could shave them off.
Then people would really stay away. That's the Grima worm tongue look. Tiberius, personality wise, though, eventually, like you said, I think something that is most indicative of his general attitude to the office that he's inherited from his stepfather, because he is Livia's son, Augustus's right. Second wife, or no, second or third wife, which makes him Augustus's stepson. Tellingly, Augustus had tried several other options prior to just sort of being like, well, yeah, let Tiberius have it, like you pointed out. Fate has kind of willed it to him, as because all the better options have died off. Again, not that there's anything particularly wrong with Tiberius. He's just not great at it. Again, he's kind of in that ancient Peter principle, sort of promoted above his capacities. And this is his not disdain for the office, but the way he sort of gets fed up with the office is best exemplified by his retreat to the Isle of Capri. It's a Mediterranean island, even today a kind of resort destination off the coast of, I believe, Naples. The Bay of Naples, where Mount Vesuvius is, which had been for a long time a favorite Roman vacation spot. Tiberius basically gets a lavish villa, which if you believe some of the more salacious stories in Suetonius, he keeps stocked with beautiful young men for darkly hinted reasons. And basically spends, what is it, the last like 10 years of his reign there? He spends the last several years of his reign not even really leaving this villa. Gradually,
he does a couple of times, right? So he early in his reign he retreats,
yeah,
and has some trouble with the people he leaves in control, and then later in his reign he leaves again,
right? And basically he's essentially forming a court around himself, but sort of leaves the empire to sort of run on its own out of Rome. The court that he surrounds himself in, one of the people he gradually brings into his orbit and actually has in this. Again, it's hard to say because Suetonius is so salacious as to hint that maybe this is rumor. But one of the people he brings into this kind of unseemly environment is the son of one of Augustus's old favorites, Germanicus. His son has the same name, but he's known by the nickname Caligula, right? His father, Germanicus, had been favored by Augustus to take over from him because, by all accounts, as we were discussing, Tacitus, who can otherwise be a slightly tedious read, in describing Germanicus, Germanicus seems to leap off the page. He's got a very strong personality. He seems to have pietas, which is unusual in the world of the late Republic and the early Empire. He seems to be sort of a throwback to the old sort of tradition of guys like Cincinnatus. And it's easy to see why a guy with a certain respect for tradition like Augustus would gravitate to someone like that to take him over. When Germanicus dies young after a distinguished career in the military, even putting down several mutinies in the German frontier, which we ought to note as a kind of dark rumble of things to come, right? That leaves basically his widow and this young son known as Caligula, which is a soldier's nickname for him. It's a slang term for it's like the diminutive of their term for their army boot. The professor who taught me Roman undergrad referred to him. You know, if we wanted to translate this about as literally as possible, his nickname would be Bootsy. So you know, we're going to get Emperor Bootsy coming down the road, and maybe being nicknamed that explains a few things.
Maybe
there's probably something else going on there. But yeah, so Tiberius has a reign distinguished by its undistinguishedness, I would say. Tellingly, for a lot of the Julio-Claudians, a lot of the sources that we have, the primary ones being Tacitus and Suetonius, it's almost like a sort of a drawing room drama that doesn't, you know, there are hints of things maybe happening on the frontiers. But by and large, it looks like the political stability created by the long reign of Augustus, the solid administrative creature that he's left behind to sort of oversee this vast empire, is stable enough and is peaceful enough to allow just this kind of weird, affluent debauchery to take over. And so the most remarkable thing in the eyes of historians of the time is the craziness that these guys are getting up to behind closed doors.
Yeah, so there's and that craziness does not undermine the empire,
right?
Right. I mean, the fact that you have a guy like Tiberius who keeps leaving power and sort of isolating himself, and then insane emperors like we'll get to in a minute, it doesn't seem to affect the people at the bottom, at least the mass of the people at the bottom. Obviously, individuals who are singled out are affected, but by and large, things in the empire go on.
Right.
Despite the people at the top. So almost everything we're talking about for the next, you know, seven or eight emperors are all kind of that top office and really nothing else, which again is truly impressive. What Augustus sets up lasts for about a century. with no major change and with no revolution, and that is impressive for the ancient world. That's impressive for the modern world. Mm-hmm. Something being that stable and lasting that long is uncommon in the political world. A couple other things on Tiberius. He transforms the office in some ways by making it personal. I don't know that you had seen a whole lot of that under Augustus. Augustus was very big on I'm fulfilling a constitutional role. I'm just another part of the Republic, maybe a new part of the Republic, this office of princeps, but still an institution, and I can be vetoed, I can be overturned, the Senate can tell me no, all of that stuff is fine. Tiberius starts to move away from that, largely because every time he would leave town and put himself in isolation, the people that he left in control would start to take more and more power unto themselves, which would make him paranoid and make him start thinking that people were out to get him. And you know, if you can't trust the people you leave in control with nearly absolute power while you're living in self-imposed exile, who can you trust? So Tiberius starts sort of seeing conspiracies everywhere and becomes increasingly paranoid, which actually, at least if we're buying the records, seems to make him a better administrator of the provinces. So you get complaints coming into Rome about, you know, corruption in government officials in the provinces. He would hear those complaints and respond with a certain level of justice. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons we know about this is because there are complaints made from a little backwater province about this guy named Pontius Pilate,
yeah.
Who's, you know, corrupt and crucifying people left and right when really he shouldn't be. Tiberius deals with that. You know, Pilate gets removed from office and fairly severely punished for a Roman citizen. So there is some level of justice that comes out of this paranoia with Tiberius in a way that does not come from later emperors. What all of that shows us is that treason is starting to be redefined as not something against the state, not something as, you know, undermining the freedom and sovereignty of the people. Now it is something that's also against the person of the emperor. So you have that idea of an office and a person. The difference between those starting to collapse.
Right.
It's no longer that there's an institution and there's the person and they're separate. Now they're becoming more and more the same thing. And again, you have the problem of succession. Tiberius had learned the lesson of the civil wars that the army is where you get power from. So when Augustus dies, the first thing he does is has the army take an oath of allegiance to him personally. Well, at that point, what is the Senate going to do? You know, right. Are they going to say no? So in fact, he works it so that when the Senate meets, the public appearance is that they are begging him to take power, rather than confirming power that he already had in reality. It doesn't solve the problem of succession. It just sort of kicks it down the road a little bit. And you mentioned Germanicus. You start to see the issue of, what on earth are you supposed to do in the Roman Empire if you're a competent bureaucrat? You don't want to be too virtuous and you don't want to be too competent. Because if you are, you're going to draw the attention of the emperor, and he's going to start thinking that you are out to get his office, sometimes rightly, sometimes wrongly. So how do you deal with that? Tacitus, one of his essays, an essay that's sort of a biopic of his father-in-law named the Agricola, deals with that. So how do you do your job well with sort of traditional Roman virtues, but not in a way that gets you killed? And that's just a tricky thing that they have to navigate. Tiberius dies presumably a natural death. There are, of course, always conspiracies about that. By all accounts, he died pretty quietly and gets replaced by Caligula. Jordan, anything else about Tiberius?
Just one other thing. Even the trappings of the office of the princeps, I think, are worth noting. Sure. I mentioned, again, he's got this kind of lavish villa that he lives on Caprii, in the you know, the Isle of Capri. And, again, spends years there. Again, possibly getting up to some very un-Roman kind of sexual activity, pigging out on food, which again is kind of an un-Roman thing to do, all of which have become increasingly common vices in the Roman world since this domination of the Mediterranean. Again, this kind of affluence breeding the sort of moral bankruptcy that's going to undermine the virtues that actually created this empire. This is in stark contrast, again, to Augustus, who, despite his power, despite his apparent control over the state, still lived in a relatively modest house in Rome, and could very often be seen just out in the street. He would walk around conducting his business in the streets of Rome, in the Forum, like any other Roman citizen. He did not sequester himself. He did not build himself lavish palaces, like we'll see with some of these later emperors, particularly Nero, with the Aurea Domus, right, the Golden House. All of that is not beneath Augustus, but rather that is not what he views as the proper purview of the first citizen who should be ruling by example. Tiberius, regardless of what his kind of personal feelings are about that, it's not in practice what he does. Again, he retreats into luxury and vice, and you know, there would be years there in which the princeps, the first citizen, would not be even be in the city.
Right, and that, again, according to the sources, him not doing his job, not living virtuously, is what's undermining his office and undermining the stability of the state.
Because one other thing that just occurred to me, but by this time the emperors are taking the title of father of their country, right?
Pater Patriae. I don't know when that started. I don't know.
I can't recall.
The titles start to build up pretty quickly, so yeah. I'm not sure exactly when that one gets added.
Right. Well, beginning with Augustus, he's the Divi Filius, right? He's the son of the god.
Right.
After Julius Caesar is deified. I can't remember when Pater Patriae, the father of your country, actually begins. But again, harking back several episodes, I think we talked about the Roman family. The role of the Pater Familius is as kind of the mediator of the entire family. And if you look at the emperor as the father of the entire empire, when a guy is not comporting himself the way a proper Roman father should, judgment falls on the entire empire.
Right, which is not to say you want him in Rome doing his job.
Right.
If he's also going to be, you know, living this opulent lifestyle, which is where a good segue, I think, into the next guy, Caligula. If you haven't read Suetonius's essay on Caligula, totally worth picking up. His biography of Caligula is spectacular. I think it's the best piece, and of the ones I've read in the 12 Caesars, I've not read all 12 of them. But he starts off with all of the positive aspects of Caligula's reign, and Caligula certainly has his moments as a competent and capable administrator. It looks like he is sort of moving Rome back in the direction of the Republic at the beginning. He rides this wave of popularity into office because his dad had been this famous general Germanicus. He has the support of the army and the support of the people, and even briefly the support of the Senate. Again, it just looks like he has this great, great start. And there's this great moment in Suetonius when he says, you know, so much for Caligula the man, now for Caligula the monster.
Yeah.
What's wrong with this guy is that he is clearly insane. We'll see some other crazy emperors, but this guy is clinically insane. So he shows up in office and just has all of these odd tastes. He has a cruel streak that is cruel to the point of, again, insanity. There's not a better word for that, which shows the weakness of this system that Augustus has set up, the weakness of what to do with someone who fills that top spot, fills that office of princeps or emperor or whatever we want to call it. It's not yet officially the emperor, but we're getting close to that. What do you do if someone's in that office who's either incapable of doing the job because of physical ailments or because he's wicked or because he's insane? There's not a constitutional process for dealing with that. It's not like the Senate or the popular assemblies can vote him out. Really, the only thing you can do is assassinate him, which, of course, is what happens. That should be very disturbing, but the full implications of the murder of an emperor don't really arise until a couple of murders down the road. For now, we just see that there is a problem in that you can't get rid of these guys other than by killing them. We could spend the rest of the episode telling Caligula stories, yeah. I think. Jordan, do you have a favorite one?
Well, there's the standards. There's the horse being nominated to the Senate. There's the army picking up seashells. I think maybe my favorite thing to tell students is the translation of the name Caligula, which I already talked about on here. Just the idea of, you know, when Romans heard the name Caligula in their native language, they were hearing something like Bootsy. Which is, of course, not how he would have wanted to be addressed. Yeah, probably the army picking up seashells. Some more recent historians, I think, have tried to walk back the idea of Caligula being insane and sort of see him as a kind of canny political operator who was intentionally trying to publicly humiliate first the Senate and then the army. I'm not totally sure I buy that.
What is his name? Anthony Barrett. I hope I'm getting the author right, and I'll correct this in the show notes if I'm not. His biography of Caligula is the one that starts that off.
Yeah, and I think I haven't read Tom Holland's Dynasty, but I think he follows along kind of in the same track. I'm not totally sure again that I buy that line of thinking. Caligula seems to be at least deeply disturbed, if not insane. And it's also, I've been reading the book you recommended last time, Charles Norris Cochran's Christianity and Classical Culture. And at various points, he notes that the Romans, especially the old Romans, one of their deep suspicions of the Orient of the East is the ease with which the Easterners, including the Greeks, especially after Alexander the Great, the ease with which they identify mere mortals with gods. Augustus, to his credit, he accepts the title Augustus, which has a kind of divine flavor to it. But he only ever wants to be known as, you know, the princeps, the divi filius, the son of a god, but not a god himself. That said, he does also turn a blind eye to the cult of Rome and Augustus that starts to gather strength, especially in the East. Already within Augustus's lifetime, he's being worshipped as a god, but he does not encourage that. Caligula apparently embraces that kind of thing. And if you can accept the stories that we have in Suetonius, he apparently does literally regard himself as a god. He denotes his sisters as goddesses and has apparently incestuous relationships with them.
Like the gods did.
Exactly. Right. So this is a guy who is embracing this role that is, you know, in a huge number of ways very, very un-Roman. And it's no surprise that historians as different as Tacitus and Suetonius are shocked and appalled by his behavior.
Yeah, and I've got to say, I have little sympathy for revisionist history in the best of circumstances.
Yeah.
But that particular kind of revisionism is not just saying, what if we read the sources slightly differently? It's mm-hmm. basically saying literally all of our sources are exactly wrong.
Yeah.
So there are all kinds of problems with that interpretation. With that said,
right.
You do have to take into account the fact that there must have been good points of his rule.
Right.
Because even Suetonius, who is the great gossip monger, tells us some things about him that are okay.
Right.
Which my favorite Caligula story is the story that he was riding through Rome in his chariot and had taken a bunch of gold coins and heated them over a fire and then was riding through Rome in the chariot and would throw, you know, wearing thick leather gloves, would throw these heated gold coins out to the mob as he went through, and people would be excited because he's throwing money, and they go to pick him up and get burned by the hot money. And then you have this sort of hot potato moment where the peasants are, you know, are trying to hold these coins while, you know, being scorched by them, which
right.
is just sort of a great picture of the level of insanity of this guy.
Yeah.
Kind of the juvenile humor at the misery of others, but still with I guess a hint of generosity in that he is giving away money.
Yeah.
There is no story.
Taking advantage of a very understandable instinct.
Sure.
Yeah. It's, we can talk about this with Nero too, but, to me, you know, a more reasonable, you know, especially the kind of deconstructionist sort of, you know, the sources are fiction, we've got to see the story behind the story or whatever. You know, if you regard your sources as fiction, I don't know why you're doing history in the first place. And there's a number of historians who talk that way, and I don't get it. So I'm pretty much there with you.
I want to make sure when we get to Christianity in Rome, we talk more about that, because that of course is the dominant stream of scholarship when it comes to the New Testament.
Yeah, yeah.
This is not really true. Instead, this other interpretation that runs directly contrary to it.
Right.
And that's one of the things that I hope is clear, at least in the way we deal with this material, if not in what we say explicitly other than right now, is we do this because we trust our sources. Right.
Yeah.
We have good tools that help us sort of tell what's true from what's not true. But by and large, the default setting is if we have a history that says something, unless we have a compelling reason not to believe it,
right.
We should believe it. And a compelling reason is not, I don't want to believe it. Right. That's not enough. It needs to be, here is another source. Here is some kind of actual evidence that says why when this main source is saying X.
Yeah. It seems like a lot of the modern...
I'm just going to say, with Caligula, all of the sources say he's nuts.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And it seems like with a lot of modern scholars, it's sort of like they have a prima facie objection to anything being interesting.
Certainly.
A crazy person is interesting, so we cannot accept that, and we have to see, you know, whatever. But the one reasonable objection I see to just the blanket insanity statement is, I guess on a personal level, with a belief in original sin, I don't necessarily have to believe a person is straight up insane to become as debauched and depraved as someone like Caligula. He apparently has enough of a sense of, like you said, a juvenile sense of humor and cruel calculation to suggest maybe he's not completely toys in the attic bonkers. But he's definitely someone who has caved in and is just reveling in his basest instincts and using the power that he has for the worst possible reasons. With Nero, I think we're going to see that kind of taste for depravity reach an even worse apex.
Well, and I guess we should talk about this when we get to Nero. I would push back a little bit and say that I actually think Nero is wicked but not insane,
right?
Whereas Caligula is both.
Yeah. I'd agree with that.
So you mentioned the idea of Caligula saying I'm a god based on, well, again, insanity, but also based on this Eastern stuff. That's one of the places where the Senate does have an active role to play, right? So Tiberius goes through, and I didn't mention this when we were talking Tiberius. Tiberius takes away the election of magistrates from the popular assemblies and gives it to the Senate. So that's the end of popular assemblies, right? They continue to sort of formally meet where you have, you know, three or four people who come together representing the Roman people. You no longer even have mass elections anymore. It's now just a strictly ritual thing until Christianity comes along and shuts even that down. But the popular assemblies that we talked about under the Republic are now gone. The Senate is picking magistrates on the recommendation of the emperor. So the institutions are gone. The one power that the Senate keeps to itself all through the end of the Western Republic is the power to declare a dead emperor a god or not. That starts with Augustus. They hold on to it all the way through. You have many emperors who come along and say, we're taking that power away from you. All the Senate has to do is wait until that emperor dies, and then they immediately take it back. Right. That is sort of the one place where they stand on their rights, as it were. And it is largely a meaningless right, but it's a right that they hold on to very, very, very firmly nonetheless. So Caligula gets assassinated. He is promptly not deified or undeified, I guess, since he had deified himself. Unfortunately, or fortunately, I suppose, depending on how you look at this next guy, Caligula had executed most of his family, leaving in place really only his uncle who had survived because everyone thought he was mentally feeble. They thought that he was not all there, toys in the attic, as you said, which on some level obviously isn't true. Claudius, by all accounts, was a great scholar. He had taught himself Etruscan, which today is sort of the equivalent of teaching yourself Old English, right? It's loosely related to Latin, but just because I can read English doesn't mean I could read Old English. Same sort of thing then. He loved reading. He loved sort of digging into histories. He was a great admirer of most things that were written. But he also walked with a limp, drooled when he talked, and I think had a pretty severe list. But I think there were some other things, those are the ones I remember off the top of my head. Because everyone thinks he's slow, the people who assassinate Caligula sort of shove him into office, thinking that they will run things with him kind of as a figurehead. And that is a place where, I guess now I'm going to contradict myself, our sources say that's basically what happened. So Tacitus and Suetonius, if you read these sections on Claudius, they're all about infighting amongst the ministers, right? So these administrators sort of going at each other, which has the good long-term effect of setting up a system of administration that basically works despite the emperor.
Right.
So we see starting to develop a bureaucracy, and I know for people on my side of the political spectrum, that bureaucracy thing can be an instant bad buzzword. It shouldn't be, right? A well-functioning bureaucracy is essential to any state. Even if it's big, it's better than having no bureaucracy at all. They don't have a big bureaucracy at this point, but they have a bureaucracy that's largely doing its job despite the emperor.
Right.
Despite his lack of direct involvement.
Hey, can I make one note there?
Yeah, go for it.
Yeah, it's worth pointing out too. I like you have this kind of distinctive conservative reaction to the word bureaucracy, and I wish for the life of me I could remember where I ran across this figure because it was just recently. But it is worth noting that even at its height, the Roman Empire was administered by a team of approximately 10,000 people, right. Which is probably about as many people as just the South Carolina DMV employs, right? So when we say bureaucracy, it's not like the kind of red tape nanny state that we're used to. The bureaucracy is compared to our government, extremely streamlined and very lean. 10,000 people to administer everything from, you know, the southern reaches of Scotland to North Africa and all the way to Syria.
Right. Well, and that is something we'll talk about down the road. So some of that, of course, is relative. So if you'd asked a Roman, is there too much bureaucracy? The answer would have been sort of this stock conservative answer today. Yeah, of course there is.
Yeah. Benefit of hindsight.
Right. But that said, yes, we still have institutions that are there to protect Roman citizens and increasingly to protect non-citizens, which we'll get to in a minute. Hopefully today, I did not mean to spend that much time on Tiberius, but getting on these guys. If it seems like we're spending a lot of time on these first few emperors, that's because that's where our sources are.
Yeah,
our best sources are on this century between Augustus and Vespasian. That's just our best writers, our best historians. That's where it all comes in. You get past that and we get into the fuzzy stuff, the stuff that we can't quite say as clearly as definitely true. But Claudius, again, everyone thinks Claudius is this feeble-minded guy. That is not necessarily the accepted narrative any longer. Jordan, you want to talk about that at all? Robert Graves and his reinvention of Claudius.
Yeah. Yeah, I talked up I, Claudius, the novel I, Claudius, and its sequel, Claudius the God, last time, and they're definitely worth reading. Again, except that what you're reading is fictionalized history, but, you know, Graves knew his sources and incorporated them very well into what I think a very engaging and interesting narrative, full of, you know, conspiracies and craziness. Again, kind of he takes Suetonius at his most fever pitch and gives you that as kind of the normative picture of this period. According to the story, the actual story here, not Robert Graves, according to the stories, Claudius is discovered in the palace in the immediate aftermath of Caligula's assassination, cowering behind a wall hanging like a curtain. Again, he had managed to make it to not just adulthood, but to middle age, despite everyone around him meeting often sudden and violent ends because of guys like Tiberius and Caligula. Tiberius especially, who got increasingly paranoid, Caligula, who was probably crazy. Again, because of the impression that he was in some way feeble-minded, it was kind of a hobby for a while, I think, for historians to try to, you know, post-facto diagnose what was wrong with Claudius. Possibly something like a kind of cerebral palsy or epilepsy. You know, there's lots of If it was epilepsy, it's possible it ran in the Julio-Claudian family, because that was also something that Julius Caesar was suspected of having. Right. At any rate, yeah, he stammered, he drooled, he was regarded generally as a harmless idiot. I think he was given some kind of token jobs in the administrative schema, just to sort of keep him occupied. But his apparent love was for scholarship. Etruscan is long lost. It's one of those kind of question marks for historians. So even though I'm not even a specialist in that kind of thing, it just pains me to think. I think Claudius even compiled an Etruscan to Latin dictionary in addition to a multi-volume history of the Etruscans. So if those were somehow still in existence somewhere, that would really clear up a lot of things, especially for the early Roman period, which we just don't have stuff for. So he's a apparently an intelligent, hardworking scholar, but that doesn't necessarily make him good emperor material. Probably the most notable accomplishment of his reign is the invasion and subjugation of Britain. And I know you've got some background in actual study of Caligula, or excuse me, Claudius and the invasion of Britain. Do you want to cover that?
Yeah, just briefly, and only because this is sort of the second to last major expansion of Rome, right? So for whatever reason, and there's a lot of discussion of this, Claudius decides that the aborted invasion of Britain by Caesar needs to be finished.
Yeah.
So the legions go in, kind of smash up the locals. Claudius makes an appearance, declares, you know, mission accomplished, and goes home. And by and large, it was. By and large, Britain sort of quickly folded. There were pockets of kind of fanatical religious resistance led by the Druids, which you get all kinds of salacious stories told about them by Roman writers. That gets stomped out by the Romans. The Romans had, as we will talk about in a couple of episodes, had pretty set methods of dealing with religious fanatics that mostly worked.
Yeah.
So they go in, they smash up the Druids. Unfortunately, unless you're a British patriot, in which case, you know, this is not necessarily a negative story. The Romans turned the government of parts of Britain over to a number of corrupt officials, including the great philosopher Seneca, who was sort of indirectly involved in all of this. They brutalized the native population, especially a tribe called the Iceni. The chief of this tribe had died. He willed half of his kingdom to the emperor of Rome with the expectation that this would mean Roman citizenship for his people, which tells us something about how desirable Roman citizenship was, even in this freshly conquered place. The local governor decides, great, I now own these people. They're not citizens. They're slaves. When the dead king's wife objects to this, he has her publicly whipped and has her daughters raped in front of her. She goes home, tells everyone what happened, stirs up her tribe, stirs up the tribes in the region, and launches a rebellion that very nearly wipes out Roman power in the island. They crush this local governor's forces. I think the Romans lose something like 2 legions to this rebellion. They burn London to the ground. It's not called London at the time, but it is London, which, from what I understand, archaeologists have recently discovered sort of the layer of ashes that was the burning of Roman London in this rebellion. This queen's name is Boudica, if I didn't mention that, which I believe everyone sort of says in the original language that means victory. So this is Queen Victoria the First, technically, I guess. So she... she marches, continues marching kind of across the island of England, finally runs into the military commander of the island, who is a competent sort of old line Roman general, who with a very small force defeats her large force of barbarians. She disappears or commits suicide, or is just killed in the battle. We don't really know. That's the end of Roman Britain. So that's sort of the end of tribal Britain and the beginning of Roman Britain. There is a book written about kind of the ongoing resistance to Rome in Britain that's inspired by this, and I'm blanking on the name of it, but the author I believe is Guy de Labore. I'll put this in the notes. It's a French name, and I'm sure I'm butchering it. Basically says that the British never really submit to Britain. I think his thesis is wrong, but there are numerous rebellions that start in Britain. So even once they're Roman, you have several emperors who get their start in Britain and sort of invade the continent from there.
And it remains an armed camp for a very long time. I mean, there's multiple legions in this one island.
Right, largely to defend against the Scots. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, largely to hold that frontier. Britain is a frontier. But you do have kind of an ongoing military state of some kind, whether it's rebellion or invasion, what have you. Why so much time on that? Because it's something I did my undergrad. That's all. It is sort of mildly interesting. Again, you have this idea of citizenship as being something very desirable, and then the Roman kind of abuse of that, right? Which we see something very similar in the Jews, which we'll talk about when we get to Christianity as well. All of that is under Claudius. He's mostly disconnected from what's going on there, other than this showing up and declaring victory, and the indirect influence of this guy named Seneca, who is a fascinating figure all around, one of Rome's greatest philosophers. When Claudius dies, Seneca writes a story about this. So, you know, the Senate is supposed to decide whether or not Claudius is a god. So in Seneca's narrative of this, in his it's not quite a novel, but it's something along those lines. He says that the Senate declares him to be a god. Claudius gets to heaven, and the other gods aren't entirely sure whether they want this limping, drooling guy to be a god or not. So they have a big debate on it in heaven. And finally, they decide that Claudius can't be a god, but they will let him be a pumpkin. So the name of this book is this wonderful word, apocalokentosis, which literally means turning into a pumpkin. So there's your word of the day. At the end of the story, the gods decide that he can't be a god, but he doesn't have to be a pumpkin, but they will let him work for them as a clerk. So he ends up being sort of the treasurer of heaven, if you will. Anything else about Claudius?
The one thing I would point toward, since we're talking about his death, he was very unlucky in his marriage. He got married during his reign to, was it Agrippina?
I think that's right.
There's several women about this time running around with female versions of the name Agrippa, and I can never keep them straight. She is the one that Cologne, Germany is named for, I believe, the Colonia Agrippinensia, which has a fantastic antiquities museum if you ever get a chance to go there. Tons and tons of great stuff that they've dug up in Cologne. He is unfortunate in this because she is extremely ambitious. She's considerably younger than he is, and she's got a young son who we know by the name of Nero. She passes a lot of that ambition on to Nero, apparently, and it's we can't be sure, but the suspicions in the sources are that she is responsible for poisoning Claudius. And I think there's a story, I can't remember the exact parameters of it right now. I believe there's even a story of Claudius kind of publicly calling her out on that at dinner one night when something tasted funny. Just the suspicion that he was being poisoned, and again, according to some of the sources, eventually I think she poisoned some mushrooms or something, which sent him off. Again, there's so many cases like this. I know some of them might be running together in my mind.
Well, and poison is the easy accusation, right?
Right. Yeah.
You can never prove it.
Yeah, exactly. Toxicology is not what it is now in those days. So, unless we can actually parse some really distinct and very clearly observed symptoms, it's hard to say if it's poison for sure or not. To an extent, what matters is that Claudius's wife. With Claudius's wife, a suspicion of that seems entirely reasonable, especially with the kid that she helps to put on the throne.
Yeah, and that's like Caligula. Nero starts off pretty well, mostly because he just does not involve himself with government. He lets these administrators keep doing their thing.
Right.
He spends most of his time writing bad poetry and bad music and going to the races.
And growing a terrible neck beard.
Yes, yes. The story that, again, is one of those that it's a fun story. It may or may not be true. Nero's mother was very unhappy with how little power Nero had. She hadn't killed Claudius, you know, so Nero could go to plays and chariot races. You know, she'd raised him to be an emperor, darn it. So she pressured him into ordering the death of several of these administrators, including Seneca, who had been sentenced to death by the three previous emperors. This is the one that actually sticks. At that point, you know, he's like 80 years old anyway, so he basically says, well, I'm not going to fight this. I'll commit suicide as I've been told to.
And Seneca was, and this is not just a case of Nero naming some bureaucrat. I mean, Seneca and Nero had a personal relationship. Seneca was his tutor for years, apparently. I'll go ahead and preempt one of my book recommendations. But just last summer, I think it was, I read a book called Dying Every Day by a classicist named James Rahm. And it's basically a look at the reign of Nero through the life of Seneca and trying, you know, because generations of historians have tried to reconcile the Seneca of this very staid, heroic, moralistic, stoic philosophy that he left behind letters and books about, and the Seneca who could in some way abet the administration of this monstrous kid that he was the tutor of. I really enjoyed that book, and I felt like Rahm did a good job of explaining how this man could be both of these people somehow.
Right. Oh, I have not read that one, so I'll have to. I'm pretty weak in my Seneca. I've read his plays, and I've read some of his fictional stuff. I've not actually read any of his nonfiction, his essays or letters. So I'll, yeah. It's one of those areas. I'm familiar, and exactly
the reverse.
Silver Age Latin stuff is one of my major weak areas, majorly weak areas. We should also note that in addition to ordering the death of Seneca, Nero a few years later also has his mother killed.
Yeah.
After many failed attempts, it's sort of a comedy of errors. If you buy Suetonius, he keeps trying these elaborate sort of Rube Goldberg attempts to have her murdered. So he builds a ship that's designed to sink once she's on it, and it sinks and she swims to shore. And I mean, all of these different types of things that just don't work.
It reads like that Pink Panther movie when everybody's trying to assassinate Inspector Clouseau, and they keep killing each other. My favorite moment, this one detail from that story may be my favorite crazy emperor story, even beyond the ones for Caligula. After the collapsible boat thing fails because inexplicably she knows how to swim, which is a minor oversight, a messenger comes from her villa to say, hey, there was a boat accident, but don't worry, your mom's okay. So Nero has I can kind of imagine it with this sort of Three Stooges body language. A guy kind of sidles up to the messenger and throws a sword at his feet, kind of like, you know, planting the gun. And Nero says, she sent a messenger to assassinate me. So they immediately have people go and just finally finish her off on this comically bad pretext.
Right. And that's probably a fair description of much of Nero's reign, sort of a dark humor that runs through the whole thing. And we'll talk more about Nero when we talk Christianity. Other political things, Nero, once he sort of gets involved in politics, things start to sink pretty quickly.
Yeah.
For better or worse, there's a lot of discussion over how good an administrator he actually was. Was he good in Rome? Was he bad in Rome? One thing that I think is generally agreed on is his entire focus was almost exclusively on the city itself. He didn't ignore the provinces, but he largely left them alone. He especially left command of the legions to the commanders in the provinces, which was the very thing Augustus had set up the system to avoid. Loyalty to the general on the scene instead of loyalty to the emperor,
right,
is where you get civil war from. And Nero had not learned that lesson. Maybe Seneca didn't do his job well, or he just wasn't reading history or whatever. Finally, the legions rebel against Nero. Anything to add on Nero?
We could talk about the fire in Rome when we talk about Christianity. It's worth noting simply that when the fire breaks out, the suspicion that the citizens of Rome have that Nero is in some way responsible for it, the fact that that story could get the vast audience that it apparently enjoyed, is suggestive of the way Nero was regarded by the public. This is where public image, I think, kind of enters our political discussion, where Augustus, who we keep going back to, which I think is also worth noting, where Augustus had very carefully cultivated his public image. Nero apparently just decides to live it up. He takes a couple of wives, I think sometimes at the same time, if I remember correctly. He has a number of lovers of both sexes. He actually marries a man. So you've got, you know, our gay marriage political considerations entering there. He associates with eunuchs and actors, which is a traditionally very un-Roman thing to do. We can tell the fun stories about him having poetry recitals that last so long that women give birth and people fake heart attacks to get out of them. But what this says to the ordinary Roman citizen is that this is a man who is consumed with himself, is completely given over to license, and like we said, is not the kind of father you want at the head of a family.
Right. No, and that's a great model to use, which I think we're sort of at the point, although, where that model will shift a bit.
Yeah.
From father to general. Maybe we're not quite there, but we're moving in that direction.
Well, the gears are certainly turning. I mean, this is a period of a lot of very subtle, unnoticed transitions. Things are already starting to shift in dramatically different directions.
Right. Although, again, if we're, you know, the man on the street in Rome, we're not noticing this because, again, this is all top level stuff.
Right.
So 68 AD, rebellion breaks out in the provinces. A rumor reaches Nero that the Senate had declared him to be an enemy of Rome. and had gone over to the side of the leader of the rebellion. So Nero commits suicide, which leads into what's called the Year of the Four Emperors. So we have three of these guys don't matter too much. A guy named Galba, a guy named Vitellius, a guy named Otho, all of whom are generals of some sort at various times in various places. One of them, and I forget which one, one of them, I believe, is Nero's brother or Nero's brother-in-law. And I'm just blanking on which of these guys.
Oh, shoot. Just going by reputation, I would guess Vitellius, because he's, if I remember my Suetonius correctly, he's like this piggish gourmand who lives for luxury. But that's a guess based on what I can recall about him.
Yeah, I don't remember. So there are some family connections here going on. All of them get declared emperor by different factions, different regions of the army. These are mostly regional. So the guy who's stationed in Germany gets declared emperor by the German legions, the guy in Spain by the Spanish legions. And the one who manages to take it to win the whole thing at the end is the guy who's the commander of the Eastern legions. This is Vespasian. Sort of the big takeaway from this year, the four emperors, first, the office of the emperor does not have to be hereditary. Right? None of these guys, other than the one who's sort of the brother-in-law of Nero, none of these guys are related to the family. In fact, Vespasian is not even a patrician, which will be relevant in a minute. And we see that the city of Rome itself is largely irrelevant. Most of these guys don't actually even make it to Rome. So this is all going on sort of out in the provinces. Vespasian, though, wins the whole thing, which leads into the Flavian dynasty. That's his name, right? I always forget where that Flavian comes from.
His full name is Titus Flavius Vespasianus.
Okay.
Why
is it the Flavian dynasty and not the Vespasian dynasty?
The Flavii are the clan, I guess. Okay. I mean, his son is also Titus Flavius Vespasianus, so you get Vespasian the first time around, Titus the second time around, I think just to avoid confusion.
Right.
And then the last son, Domitian, who does not have quite the sterling record that his brother and father do. I think if we're just going by clan, you know, the Julii, the Claudians, right? You get the Julio-Claudians, then by extension, the Flavians.
Right. Well, what should we know about sort of the Flavians overall? This is one of your areas of focus, right? So what do we think about these guys?
Well, it's barely one of my areas. This is a family of generals. You mentioned that Vespasian does not even come from a patrician family, and he does not apparently have a chip on his shoulder the way some earlier, you know, new men might, the way Cicero kind of, as much as I love Cicero, he had that common, you know, kind of wearing his learning on his sleeve sort of thing that, you know, a lot of, you know, lower class kids who make good do. Vespasian apparently is content to just be himself, and he's got a famously earthy sense of humor. As emperor, someone in his administration had started to tax public toilets, and someone complained to him about this. This was really unseemly. We shouldn't be taxing, you know, the loo, so to speak. Vespasian, according to the story, holds out a gold coin to the guy, holds it up under his nose, and basically says something to the effect of, you know, gold doesn't smell. If you're worried about, you know, getting involved in taxing toilets, don't worry. The money smells the same regardless. To go by his portrait busts, he looks like kind of a cheery old guy to me. That masks a pretty, a force to be reckoned with in the Roman military. This is the guy who is immediately in charge of the rebellion that breaks out in Judea, the one that culminates in the destruction of the temple in AD 70. Vespasian is the one in charge on the ground at first with his son Titus. Josephus has an entire book dedicated to this rebellion, which is widely available thanks to its relevance to early Christian history. When the year of the four emperors comes around and Vespasian gets the nomination, he leaves the command of subduing that rebellion to his son Titus and heads back to Rome, where he apparently does a pretty good, capable job, first of all, of shoring up the imperial power. which he's got to do through a certain amount of force. This is where we see the military clearly starting to run the show, right? The wagon is now, or excuse me, the cart is now well before the horse. So you got this general who's not just acclaimed emperor, but he's actually becomes emperor and hangs on to it for a number of years. He sets about doing public works projects. The most famous example, completed during the reign of himself and his two sons, is the what used to be called the Flavian Amphitheater, what's now known as the Colosseum. Gets the nickname the Colosseum because of a colossal statue of Nero dressed as the sun, which was standing next door, and apparently was just too big to bother tearing down for a long time. It's possible that the statue was tall enough to peek into the Colosseum, which had to be unnerving if you were just there to see an animal hunt. It's kind of a measure of Vespasian's canniness, I guess, because just a few of those building projects tells you something about his relation to the people. Where Nero was just going to live it up and enjoy what he conceived of as the good life, what would have obviously astonished or horrified his tutor Seneca, Vespasian very publicly goes about demolishing some of Nero's handiwork. They've just recently excavated some of the Aurea Domus, that golden house of Nero's, which Vespasian set about partially deconstructing. The Colosseum was actually built in the footprint of Nero's private lake on the grounds of this massive palace, taking something away from this loathed tyrant and giving it back over to the people. Of course, the entertainments that they hold in the Colosseum are horrifying to our minds, and that tells us something entirely different about Roman culture. But the fact that Vespasian is doing this is kind of a public measure of at least his intentions for the office of the emperor. Titus kind of continues in the same tradition. Vespasian and Titus are both pretty well regarded, especially Titus as a victorious general. His triumphal arch is still in the Forum. You can visit it and actually see the golden candelabra. The seven-headed lampstand from the temple being carried into Rome in his triumph, which is really amazing to see. Again, if you ever get a chance to see that. Titus continues in somewhat the same tradition as his father when he becomes emperor, but he does not reign as long as his father does, and ultimately the office of the princeps devolves upon Domitian, who has a little bit more of the savage reputation of someone like a Nero, combined with kind of the paranoia of Tiberius. Anything you would want to add to that? I've just given kind of a thumbnail sketch.
Just a couple of things to add about Vespasian. Like you said, he genuinely seems to be both a good guy and a good emperor. He was certainly a decent administrator. He seems to have that sort of what today we would say that common sense that both corruption and bad administration could do serious damage to everyone in the empire, sort of common people and wealthy people alike. So he goes to work and does his best to install good government sort of across the board. One of the things he does, and this is only hinted at in the sources, our sources for Vespasian are not as good as some of our sources for other folks are. We basically, I think, only have Suetonius and a Greek writer named Cassius Dio. Both of whom are writing fairly shortly after him. But he reforms the way the provinces are administered by doing away with most forms of tribal and local government and sort of bringing everyone into the Roman fold. So up until this point, we didn't really go into provincial administration. Up until this point, basically, all of the borders of the Roman Empire are going to be run just by the local tribal aristocracy or whatever form of government they have. So if you're, if you're in Turkey and you're a Greek city, you might have a democracy running things. There will be a Roman governor there to collect taxes and to basically supervise Roman citizens, but that's really all he does. So if you think kind of what's going on in the New Testament with the trials of Paul and the trials of Jesus, why do they get bounced around between all these different officials? Well, it's because you have these different layers of bureaucracy.
It's kind of the Persian model under Cyrus, where
it is.
It's more harmonized than standardized.
Right. So it's sort of a crypto federalism. Vespasian does away with that, which in a sense is taking away, you know, whatever's left of their freedom. But he doesn't just take it away. He gives them something back. And he does this by instituting the most thorough census that Rome had ever taken. So they count not just people, but also the financial and material needs of each part of the emperor, each part of the empire, which means that the entire sort of structure of the emperor gets reorganized and adjusted. Vespasian uses this as a chance to open up the Senate to very distinguished provincials. So people who had served well in the military or had shown themselves to be capable administrators in provincial governments are put into the official Roman government, even if they'd never held an earlier political office. So this is sort of the end of the Senate as a Roman aristocracy in the ethnic sense of the term. And it's the end of the Senate as a Republican institution, but it's the beginning of the Senate as the aristocracy of the empire. So from this point on, the Senate is something that belongs to the empire as a whole. You can still get there through the old cursus honorum. It is still open to, you know, people in the offices back in Rome. But the emperor is always going to add more senators than make it there through that old path. This means that conquered peoples now have access to the structure of the empire. And they end up basically becoming loyal. You see rebellions against individual emperors. You never really again see rebellions in the name of, you know, my local tribe, at least not on any scale that matters. In fact, we'll see emperors in just a couple of minutes. We'll see emperors who start coming from these ranks of provincials, people who are not Roman in any meaning of the term. So Vespasian is not a patrician. He is still a Roman. In the next century, we see emperors who are not even Roman. They're Gaulish or Spanish or what have you. It also undermines what's left of Republican institutions. So why do you need to serve as a consul when you can just skip it and jump into the Senate? That, of course, is not Vespasian's intent. And probably most importantly, maybe that's the most important thing, but Vespasian also institutes what's called the Law of the Emperor Vespasian. This outlines specifically the role of the emperor in the Roman constitution, his powers and his responsibilities. It is not the final say in what the emperor can do, but it's the basics of it. Now the emperor is an official office, right? It is part of Roman government. And at least in theory, it sets limits on the office. So if you write down the list of things the emperor can do, the implication is that if something isn't on the list, the emperor cannot do it. Practically, of course, the emperor is still a monarch, but in the mind of the Romans, this is an office with discrete limits that cannot be transgressed.
Yeah.
So Vespasian, he ends the civil wars. He stabilizes the empire enough that it goes on for another century with no civil war. So if the main goal of a Roman emperor is to prevent this kind of insurrection, Augustus reforms last about a century. Vespasian's reforms last about another century. With that short intermission of the year of the four emperors, which again does not really affect the people of the empire, it's a high level kind of military issue. These 200 years of Pax Romana are mostly uninterrupted. So Rome is at peace internally. It's mostly left alone by barbarians externally. Not that they left the barbarians alone themselves, but at least Rome wasn't being invaded, which again is not to say everything was all sunshine and puppies, but it does do a very good job sort of stabilizing things. I don't know that I have anything to add about Titus. He didn't rule very long, so you know we don't have a whole lot about him. Although we sort of know a disproportionate amount about him, because he was buddies with Josephus.
Right.
So we have a fairly good view of his reign and his time as a general, because one of the major historians of the period wrote a lot about it. Domitian, I think Domitian is interesting. Possibly killed Titus to get his job. Maybe not. We don't know for sure. From what I can tell, he tried to do what earlier tyrants had done, what Nero and Caligula and those folks had done, and take as much power to himself as he could have. But unlike them, he did try to do a good job, you know, running the office. Mm-hmm. He tried to sort of be just and fair. He takes that full weight of rule on his own shoulders, but he tries to carry it well. Doesn't mean that everything he does is wise and virtuous, but he's making the effort, especially at the old Augustan program of reestablishing religious and social laws.
Yeah.
Right, so he tries to retrench the old Roman virtues, the old Roman virtues. He orders people, you know, to go back to church, the pagan temples anyway, and commands them to lay off the booze. He doesn't make prohibition an actual law, but he does outlaw the growing of grapes. So again, it's an interesting approach, you know, sort of an autocratic attempt to bring morality back to Rome. Like previous emperors, he is suspicious of anyone who looks too competent. He doesn't have any children, so in his eyes, anyone who stands out too much is probably angling to become emperor. So he has a habit of punishing people who distinguish themselves on the field of battle, who look like they're more popular than he was, which makes him look bad in public. When that's your personality, people are always kind of nervous around you. And in 96 AD, Domitian is assassinated by his household staff. You know, it's hard to find good help, and Domitian didn't. That's the end of the Flavians. Anything to add on those, Jordan?
Domitian probably almost certainly related to his religious reforms, also had one of the first large-scale persecutions of Christians,
right.
Which I think we can also kind of pass that off until we discuss Christianity specifically. There's just two more things I would note about Vespasian that I should have earlier. One was – I kind of nodded to this, but he I am won over by anybody with any kind of self-deprecating sense of humor. I just kind of enjoy that. This it's not just a personality thing, though. I think it says volumes again about his approach to the Principate, as opposed to someone like Nero, who had to be praised as the fastest charioteer and the greatest poet. Vespasian is constantly cracking jokes against himself and will have none of this emperor as god stuff. That's, you know, he's just a soldier who's running the empire, and this goes right up to his deathbed, right? The last words of Nero as he gets a slave to help stab himself in the throat is, you know, the world is losing such an artist. Vespasian on his deathbed jokes, oh dear, I'm turning into a god. You know, it's a subject of fun for him. And I think that kind of self-deprecation, I wouldn't go so far as to call it humility, because that's itself a pretty un-Roman character trait. But I think that approach to the Principate, in addition to his reforms, probably brings it back from the brink of collapse and helps sustain it for another, you know, however many centuries. The other thing I would note is that he told, in relation to who would succeed him, he made it very clear that at least in regard to his transfer of power, it was going to be hereditary, which is something that had been kind of masked under the Julio-Claudians, like we talked about. With Vespasian, he kind of brings that out into the open. And in the words of Suetonius anyway, says that, you know, it's going to be either of my sons or nobody.
Right.
So we've now got rudimentarily defined position and responsibilities and duties and at least theoretically limits to what it is that the emperor is. Oh, we've also got the pattern established that from here on out, it's going to be in some sense hereditary, although that's going to be very quickly modified by the five good emperors.
So we sort of transition from there into from three, you know, one good emperor, two sort of okay emperors, into, you know, what you just pointed out are called the five good emperors. The Senate and the army both declare Nerva to be the emperor following the assassination of Domitian, who is then followed by Trajan, who is then followed by Hadrian, followed by Antoninus Pius and Marcus Aurelius. These are probably the period in Roman history, other than the Julio-Claudians, that are most well known, mostly because of what Gibbon has to say about them. So Edward Gibbon says that this is the period in history under these five emperors when mankind was most happy and most free. Whether that's true or not is largely irrelevant. Gibbon said it so well; it's sort of stuck with people.
I hadn't planned to hate on that very famous paragraph, but I'll just note my disagreement and move on.
Oh, I
I think that says more about Gibbon's. I think that says more about Gibbon's prejudices than about actual historical circumstance. But
right,
we can
right.
talk about that later.
You know, I think I also disagree with it, but I will do it from a position of love. I love Edward Gibbon. If there is a if there's one book I wish I could force every history and politics major to read, it would be The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, with the understanding that it's not one book, it's like six volumes. So yeah. Realistically, it's never going to happen. But practically, I think it's just fantastic. And we'll undoubtedly talk more about that when we get to the end of Rome.
Oh, yeah.
So that said, I don't know that we could disagree that this is a time of peace and prosperity.
Yeah.
We get the last expansion of Rome here, right, into what is modern day Romania. Rome sort of extends its boundaries a little bit there. Sort of works, sort of doesn't. I mean, it is a Latinate country today. Romanian is a Latin tongue. They never really get fully Romanized the same way everyone else does. But by and large, not much in the way of civil insurrection, not much in the way of invasion. All of these emperors are just. Jordan, what are we supposed to do with these guys? What are the big points of the reign here?
The five good emperors are interesting because, in my mind, only Trajan and Marcus Aurelius are actually personally interesting. There are a lot of Hadrian fanboys out there. I'm not one of them. I don't have anything against Hadrian. I just don't find him particularly enticing. I'll talk a little bit about Trajan and Marcus Aurelius, if that's okay with you.
Sure.
To me, they stand out because they are distinct personalities in what is a reign of efficient, good-natured, if not wise, then at least circumspect emperors. The most important thing that they do is that while they retain Vespasian's idea of a hereditary office, they only pass, with the exception of Marcus Aurelius, and we can talk about this mistake later, they only pass the office along to adopted sons, which means that essentially it is still hereditary. You've got father-son relationships, which the Romans took very seriously, even through adoption. But they are adopting, as adults, only the people that they find qualified by dint of personality and experience to actually occupy that position. And then they have co-reigns for quite a while. We've got the five good emperors, Nerva, Trajan, Hadrian, Antoninus Pius, and Marcus Aurelius. There's a number of other guys in there as well who co-reign for a while but never reign independently as sole emperor that we could also talk about. So we've got, if you were to put this on a timeline with these guys' reigns arranged as, you know, continuous lines, there would be lots of overlap between them. And this was a wise precaution for stabilizing the transition of this office from one person to another. That's going to forestall a lot of the military drama that's going to come up in the next century, where the emperor dies and you immediately have four different armies acclaim their general as the emperor, and then they've got to duke it out, and then you get the exact same thing over again within 2 years when all of those guys are dead. I think the most important thing about the five good emperors is the stable transition of power, which lasts for nigh on 100 years, which is exceptional considering some of what's come before and what's definitely by the standards of what's going to come after.
Right, and without assassination.
Yes, right, so yeah. Right. Natural deaths, which has been unheard of for about a century. One thing I'll point to with Trajan, as you pointed out, he sets out to conquer what's at that time called Dacia, which is roughly coterminous with modern-day Romania. There was a Romanian student at the college I went to who was named Ovid. It was the modern Romanian form of Ovid, but they still named their kids after Romans, which I find just personally awesome. Without getting into the nitty-gritty of it, this is, again, one of the last expansions of the Roman Empire before it begins to serially contract. There's a few other kind of expeditions into places like Armenia and Mesopotamia, but Dacia is the one that is the biggest victory for Trajan. And it's the one that we know probably the most about because of Trajan's column. If the Arch of Titus shows us the temple treasures entering Rome, only to disappear from history after that, Trajan's column is this really, really remarkable record of the conquest of an entire people in a very large region. Dacia had historically been very, very resistant to conquest. Even the Macedonians had not really wanted to fool around with them. The Romans had a tough campaign of it, but they ultimately succeeded. And again, apparently fairly successfully Romanized them. And I'm not going to get into the nitty gritty of it, but what I see in Trajan's reigns are two distinct but subtle signs of transition through these periods. We've already talked a little bit about this. But the first is something that we can tell from the written accounts of not just the conquest of Dacia, but as early as Josephus's account of the Jewish War, and that is the increasing specialization of the Roman army. The legions are already starting to not be super Roman, except culturally. The legion that was stationed in Judea that had units stationed in Judea at the time of Christ's life, the 10th legion for Tensus, had at least ostensibly been raised in Syria. So we've already got a ethnically and culturally mixed army that is at the same time a tool of Romanization. But at the same time, the Romans that we see on Trajan's column that we have archaeological evidence for are wearing very exaggerated shoulder, neck, and head protection. And based on what we see them doing on Trajan's column and what we have records of them doing in things like the Siege of Jerusalem, is that the actual Roman infantry units of the legions have essentially become combat engineers. The fighting that we see, especially on Trajan's column, and I'm indebted in this observation to a book called Soldiers and Ghosts by a historian named J.E. Linden. I'll promote that again at the end of the episode. A lot of the hardcore fighting is being done by auxiliary troops and by allied troops who are not necessarily going to be wearing Roman equipment. The Roman soldiers, you know, Marius's mules, by this time are very, very specialized kinds of soldiers who will do a lot of building under fire, so to speak. So they are, you know, it's not like they're hanging back and not doing anything. But they are responsible for a lot of construction projects, for siege engineering especially. And that specialization is going to continue until the bulk of the army is going to be made up of non-Romans fighting in their traditional styles. Again, that's not the case during Trajan's reign, but we can already see hints of that transition toward that, and that's going to cause a lot of trouble down the road. Anything you would add to that?
Not to the military side of things. Again, the campaign in Dacia is the big one. How Rome did it work? Did it really Romanize? It sounds like we might disagree a little bit there. Obviously, there's Romania today, so you know there's a level of Romanization that goes on. But like you said, they had a hard campaign of it. From what I understand, they Romanized by basically exterminating the population there and resettling it.
Pretty much. I didn't mean to kind of gloss over that, but yeah, you're essentially right.
Other than that, Trajan. Yeah, I just is he the one that gets chewed out by the old lady, or is that Hadrian? Where he's I get that story confused.
I want to say it's Trajan.
So he's out riding his horse one day, and this lady's like, "Hey, that's the emperor. I have this problem with a local judge." So she starts shouting at him, and the emperor's like, "Look, lady, I don't have time to deal with your you know whatever it is that you're dealing with." So her reply is, "Then don't be emperor."
I want to say that's Trajan, but I can't remember for sure.
I don't remember either. Anyway, it's one of those things that probably not a true story, but does show some expectation that the emperor is accessible.
Yeah,
that, you can appeal to Caesar and have some kind of understanding that that will, you know, end you up near to Caesar somewhere.
Yeah, and he's
No, it's just as we see in the New Testament, there is an idea that that does still mean something.
Yeah, and he's it's worth noting that he's respected enough that a kind of tradition arises in the Middle Ages, and you see this in the Paradiso of Dante. Trajan is in heaven in Dante, and of course this is allegorical. Dante gets taken too literally too often, but this is an allegory because he's in the realm of just rulers. We're seeing the heavenly model of what a ruler is supposed to be, and he had to find some way to get a good ruler, a good emperor in there because of Dante's kind of political leanings. And he drew on a medieval tradition that Trajan had actually been raised from the dead just long enough to convert to Christianity and enter the afterlife as a believer, which says something about the reputation that Trajan enjoys even beyond the fall of the Roman Empire, which is curious because of his relationship with the Christians, which is the other transition I wanted to point to. And I meant to go back and reread these letters last night. I did not have time to, so I'm just going to go on what I remember. But in the vast correspondence of Pliny the Younger, who was an eyewitness to the eruption of Mount Vesuvius in Pompeii, Pliny, as a provincial governor, corresponds regularly with the emperor, and this is one of the first major pieces of written evidence we have from an administrative position on this new problem of these people called the Christians. We can talk in more detail about it later, but Pliny is kind of confused by these people, as a lot of Romans tended to be. They tended to be equated with the Jews because it started within Judaism, right? Claudius, when he expelled the Jews from Rome, it's possible that that was in some way aimed at some sort of nascent Christian population. We can't be totally sure. But as Pliny writes back and forth with Trajan about this, it's clear that they're trying to figure out what to do with these people. It's clear that they can't be allowed to operate as they are because that's a threat to the integrity, the spiritual and political integrity of the of the empire, but exactly what to do with them is still kind of an open question. We can talk more about that when we talk about Christianity. Anything you would have to say about that?
No. Well, like you said, we'll get back to that when we get to Christianity. So anything with these other guys, other individuals?
Maybe with Marcus Aurelius real quick, but just those two things, the Christians and the specialization of the Roman army are things even beyond Trajan's personal history that stand out to me as kind of signaling that we're moving in a dramatic new direction and nobody's really aware of it yet. The only other of the good emperors that I'll talk about, you can take Hadrian if you like I said, I'm not really up on Hadrian. Marcus Aurelius, who was a big favorite of mine in college because of the movie Gladiator, got multiple editions of his Meditations, which are good reading. Marcus Aurelius is notable because he does have a military reputation. He does put down a number of rebellions in the frontier areas of what would nowadays kind of be Austria-Hungary and parts of the former Yugoslavia. This is what you see at the beginning of the movie Gladiator in extremely fictionalized form. The big thing to note about him is that he takes this principle that has been the norm up to this point of adopting a successor who will be qualified, who he knows personally will do justice to the office of the emperor. Marcus Aurelius, for unknown reasons, decides that that's not the way he's going to go, and he leaves the throne to his son Commodus. Anything you would add to Marcus Aurelius before we jump into?
certainly the most philosophically interesting of the emperors up until Constantine, I think. He was himself a student of philosophy. He endowed four schools of philosophy in Athens. So the Academy, which of course is Plato, the students of Plato, the Lyceum, which is kind of the heirs of Aristotle. It was the smallest of these schools. The ancient world was just not impressed with Aristotle. It's kind of a miracle that we have this stuff. The porch, which would be where the Stoics sort of resided, which is what Marcus Aurelius was himself.
Right.
And then the garden, which is the Epicureans. Aurelius, he was a Stoic. His Meditations, I've not read all of it. It is on my list, but I haven't done the whole thing. The bits I have read are just really depressing.
Yeah.
The idea that there's nothing you can really do to affect politics, so you might as well accept your fate, coming from the most powerful person in the world,
right,
is just an interesting position.
Yeah, and one of the historians I was reading a couple of weeks ago to sort of brush up made the point, which I think is interesting, that there was a pretty severe persecution of Christians under Marcus Aurelius, and so we have to. The mystique of Marcus Aurelius's Meditations has kind of lulled a lot of people into thinking of him as this kind of wise, benevolent old man. When he was a Roman emperor, and he did fulfill all the duties attendant upon being the Roman emperor. He did savagely repress rebellions. He did repress religious rebellion, so to speak. If you focus strictly on the Meditations, these kind of, again, very fatalistic, semi-depressing meditations that he had, you're going to get a skewed picture of Marcus Aurelius. You can't take the image that he presents of himself in what are essentially journals as gospel, so to speak.
Well, and it's not an inconsistency though either, right? So,
right.
So
yeah,
he'll say something just, like, you know, you need to go along with the mores of where you live because that's what you're born into, and just accept your fate and live virtuously. Then you have these Christians who won't do that.
Right.
Like, no, we will not worship the gods of the place where we live.
Right.
Even if you kill us, we won't do that. Well, yeah, I mean, the logical conclusion for a good Stoic is, well, I guess I have to put you to death.
Right. Yeah, I guess the temptation is for like a kind of modern mindset of sort of liberal toleration to read itself into Marcus Aurelius if all you're getting is the Meditations. Right. This kind of, you know, spiritually open sort of seeker vibe that you get from him is only part of the picture.
Right. Yeah. And again, by and large, a good emperor, but with his failings, of course. I don't know that I would have anything to add about him beyond that, other than this problem of succession again, where you have him passing the empire onto his son, which is the first father-son succession in more than a century, right? since Titus and Vespasian.
Mm-hmm.
Again, Gibbon has some great things to say about both that century and the breaking of this pattern. And so Commodus breaks the pattern and is certainly a tyrant in the old vein of Caligula and Nero. So there is some precedent for his actions there. And we will we'll get into that next time. We're already running long in this episode. Just a few questions to round out this episode. Starting with of the ones we've talked about so far, Jordan, who would you rank as the best emperor? Who would you rank as the worst emperor? And who do you think is just the craziest? And we'll treat this as sort of a bracket like you suggested off air, and we'll compare these next time with some of our also crazy emperors in the next chunk. What's your ranking here? Where would you put these guys? So best emperor, worst emperor, craziest emperor.
With best, I don't know if I would have said this until we actually talked through it, but I think I'll just go with Vespasian. If we're not going to include Augustus in this bracket, so to speak. Vespasian, I admire, you know, as a military historian, I admire him for his military achievement, even if it was, again, we could talk, maybe y'all could do like a just war episode somewhere down the road. I think that's an important topic.
Sure.
But I can at least admire him for his guts and his stamina. I like him personality-wise. Again, I like the kind of cheery old man with a slightly juvenile sense of humor, but not the cruelty of Caligula. I like that he did not take himself or his office too seriously. He did not have the ego of the worst of the emperors. And the reforms that he instituted, even beyond the, you know, kind of personal things that I like about him, his reforms, I think, speak well to his time in the office. I think the fact that he was able to shore up what was already a tottering institution and give it another 100 years or more of life speaks well for his reign. Worst? Let me do craziest first.
sure.
I'll probably just go with Caligula. Caligula, again, if we, you know, go with just depraved or straight up insane, and I lean toward depraved and insane like we talked about, he's got to be up there. The fact is, the imperial administration was able to put up with a paranoid libertine like Tiberius, and eventually were able to put up with Nero for a considerable amount of time. Caligula was on the throne, what, just over 2 years, just under three, something like that. I can't remember the exact time frame. The fact that they got rid of him so quickly, is indicative, I think. So I think that's a pretty easy choice. As for worst, let me scroll back through our list. I think I'll go with Nero. He combined the libertinism and just nasty lifestyle of Caligula with a little taste of Tiberius in there, with the egomania of, you know, kind of an Eastern potentate. And the difference between him and Caligula, I would say, that would make Nero maybe the worst as opposed to just the craziest, is that he threatened to really damage the structure that Augustus had worked so hard to build. With Caligula, it's sort of like crazy guy, get rid of him. With Nero, it threatened to bring the whole thing down around him, like, you know, Samson pulling those pillars down. So for best, I would probably go with Vespasian, craziest Caligula, worst Nero. What you got?
Yeah, I'd agree on the best, assuming that we are leaving Augustus out of the running. If you include Augustus, I think Vespasian and Augustus have sort of a good competition between the two of them.
Yeah.
Craziest, man, that's I think is a hard one, especially if we're excluding Commodus from today. I will agree with you on Caligula, I think, because in part I think he actually was insane. In terms of worst, there's a part of me that really wants to say Marcus Aurelius.
just because of that one choice.
You know, but that one choice just wrecks the empire.
Yeah, I actually thought of that when I was trying to pick. That I would be inclined to agree with you if you went that way.
Well, the problem is he does rule so well by himself. So I think, I think I might actually go Dark Horse here and go with Claudius. Just because if Robert Graves is right and he is this like master Machiavellian manipulator, he didn't do it very well. Like it took, two millennia before someone came along and was like, oh, maybe he was a good emperor, which, is a mark against him. And again, based on the sources, it sounds like he's really not doing much.
So again, I'm
excluding the crazy guys from the running for the worst. So I would leave Nero and Caligula off that list. But I mean, if we're including them, I would agree with you about Nero. But I think I'm going to say Claudius. And that's assuming I don't know as much about Galba, Vitellius, and Otho. I have not read Suetonius. Suetonius has a biography of each of them, and I have not read it. So
they're short. I think one of them is like 3 pages. I mean,
right. Domitian obviously had his issues as well, but I'll stick with Claudius on that one. So relevance for today, maybe let's hold off on that until we're finished with the emperors. We've got a few more to go. Obviously, the big point of comparison here will be the U.S. presidency, right? Which is not quite imperial yet, depending on who you talk to. but we're now talking about character and competence, which is what we talk about when we talk about the presidency. We'll wait on that until we're through the Severan dynasty, and then we'll pick that up in the next episode. Recommendations for reading, and then this is not in the notes, but I do want to at least mention it. There's a lot of movies made about these guys.
Yeah.
Do we have any specific things to watch or to avoid when we're going through that? So what do you have in terms of reading and watching recommendations?
I'll go to I'll do the historian thing and go to our sources first. Sure. We talked a lot about Tacitus and Suetonius. They're great reading for a variety of, they are different writers with different strengths. I recommend both of them. And again, I've actually got my Penguin Classics sitting on the desk here with me. I am a Penguin fanboy, as everybody's probably figured out by now. The translation of Suetonius that I have is actually Robert Graves's, and it's got notes and an introduction by Michael Grant to kind of bring our discussion full circle. One of the volumes of Tacitus is translated by Michael Grant. We haven't gotten into all of these yet, but one of our big sources for the years of the good emperors is a controversial text called the Historia Augusta, which you can find a huge variety of opinions on. At worst, it's a total fabrication or kind of a ancient Roman joke that we don't get, like someone 2,000 years from now reading The Onion. At best, it is a very, very flawed but sort of reliable outline of what's going on. You can get that in the Penguin Classics as well under the title Lives of the Later Caesars. Mm-hmm. It's only the first half of it, but I would recommend that. A couple of other sources that we've talked about, I think we mentioned Cassius Dio. Tacitus, of course, has his history of that rebellion in Britain under the title of the Agricola. You can usually find that packaged with another essay called The Germania, which is sort of an early ethnography. I'll go ahead and recommend that too, because we're going to be talking about my folks, the Germans, a lot coming up here soon. As for more recent things, James Rahm's Dying Every Day about Seneca and Nero is excellent, and I would recommend it. And I guess I'll just hold back and just recommend two this time. The other would be J.E. Lyndon's Soldiers and Ghosts, which especially as the military comes to increasing prominence in Roman politics during this period, you can learn a lot from that book. It's a very good outline of the kind of trajectories, first of the Greek military experience and then Roman military experience. And I'm indebted to that book for a lot of what I understand about the way Roman politics and the military change at this time. You want to go ahead and do books and then we'll do movies?
Yeah, so I'd agree with you on the primary sources. We mentioned Pliny's letters. The letters between him and Trajan about the Christians are the most famous, but he was the governor of a province. So if you want sort of an inside look of what practical administration looked like, his letters are worth picking up. You mentioned Josephus, which, we'll talk more about him later, but he's also worth reading. And Seneca, again, I've read the fictional stuff. I'm told the nonfiction is better, which is fine. His fiction is not that great, honestly. Romans didn't really do good fiction. They sort of looked askance at it anyway.
There's speculation too that the fiction was kind of kiss up projects for Nero,
right?
Which doesn't usually produce good art.
Right. And so the nonfiction, I guess I will recommend, despite not having read it.
I'll recommend it.
Well, there's a satirist that I will recommend named Lucian. Lucian of is it of Samosata? Samosata, something like that. He is fantastic. Some of it is fiction, some of it is nonfiction, some of it is fiction intended to sort of highlight the foibles of everyday life. We have, I think, our only Roman novel from him called The Golden Ass, where he walks through different aspects, different philosophical schools, different religions in the ancient world, makes fun of them without mercy, but in doing so gives us a picture of sort of what they believe, including one of our earliest views of the Christians, which is interesting. Spoiler alert, he basically says, hey, these guys have they take good care of each other, they obviously have a very strong community life, but man, they believe this just crazy stuff. he is sort of the at one point the imperial investigator into cults. So we have some good stories about how the government looked at religion from the perspective of the government out of him. It's a little early for some of these guys, but some of our great Roman orators come from this time also. So Dio Chrysostom is doing his thing, wherein he would kind of be a traveling roadshow as an orator, a very different view of motivational speaking than we have. You'd basically go out in public and start talking, and people would throw money at you while you're speaking if you were doing it well. None of this paying up front stuff, you had to actually give a good speech. And Dio did. So we have some good speeches from him. I think those are the primary sources. Secondary sources, ones we mentioned in the past, Gibbon and Cochrane, still relevant. I like a book called Emperors of Rome by a guy named David Potter, who I suspect has sort of a love-hate relationship with this book. It is really well written. It is very well researched as a work of both scholarship and popular fiction. It's a good, or not fiction, a popular nonfiction. It's a good blending. The publisher published it functionally as a coffee table book. So if you pick it up, it's this, it's like a foot by 2 feet or whatever. I mean, it's not quite that big, but it's this large volume clearly intended to sort of lay on someone's coffee table and never be read. It's really, really, really well done. And he goes through every emperor, sort of talks about the political and historical aspects and military aspects later on of what's going on. It's worth picking up. I think that's all I've got. This second century stuff I'm pretty weak on in terms of secondary sources. Movies. So you mentioned Gladiator. I don't know anyone who wouldn't recommend that movie other than really hardcore ancient historians. I think it's a lot of fun, but it's also obviously not very accurate.
I have the same attitude toward that I do Braveheart, where if you just accept it as fiction set in ancient land, you go to the Disney if there were a Disney theme park of just, ancient world land, that's just like this ridiculous mishmash of all kinds of ancient stuff crammed together.
Sure.
It's enjoyable. Yeah. But look at it as essentially fiction.
Unrelated, well, sort of loosely related. Have you seen the Dwayne Johnson Hercules?
Yeah, have I
very
seen?
Very similar, right?
Yeah, except Gladiator is a good movie.
Oh, come on, it was a great movie. I like B movies, so I'm okay with that.
I really liked The Rock in that role, but because The Rock, like Vespasian, doesn't take himself too seriously, and I enjoy that.
Yes.
I really wish they had put him in a straight Hercules story instead of some kind of, you know, deconstructionist, whatever you call that. What is it? Euhemeristic sort of story.
Yeah.
I enjoyed him, but by and large, yeah.
I enjoyed it. I mean, what's his name in it? Was also Al Swearengen. Real name. Ian McShane.
Yes. Yeah.
It's a B movie, but I also really enjoyed the Hercules series in the 90s. So,
gotcha.
It makes sense that I would also like the functional movie. Anyway, that's a tangent from Gladiator. Other things that you'd recommend?
One thing I want to note, I had to look this up. I'm not trying to gainsay anything. Apuleius wrote The Golden Ass. But
Apuleius, right.
Yeah, and I would definitely recommend The Golden Ass because it's hilarious. It's got a lot of potty humor, which I'm ashamed to admit I enjoy, but it does offer you a kind of, because it is a fantastic story that also functions as a frame story, you get lots of vignettes of life in the Roman Empire about this time, so I would definitely recommend that. Looking that up to confirm that, though, I think what you were talking about was The Passing of Peregrinus by Lucian.
Yep.
In which Peregrinus takes advantage of the generosity of Christians. Somehow I had not heard of that, so I'm going to go digging that up because that sounds excellent as well.
Well, and if you're going to read something by Lucian, I should not have mentioned The Golden Ass because it wasn't written by him, so thank you for the correction.
No, it's good.
The things to read are his story, his relating of the cult of Alexander, what was his name? Alexander of Abinutica, I think. Alexander the False Prophet is the name of the story. And I believe, now maybe I'll just mix this up again, he wrote a parody of the Odyssey.
Yeah, I think I saw that in the list. I know I've read some of Lucian, but none of this sounds familiar to me, so that must have been, you know, in undergrad or something.
Right. Well, no, I appreciate the correction. It's been a while since I've looked at this.
Well, that also gave me some awesome new stuff to look up.
Well, there you go. So yeah, sorry. Other movies to recommend from our Julio Claudians, Flavians, or Good Emperors.
Well, there's the I Claudius miniseries, which is I've heard that they're actually going to make a remake of I Claudius. I think for cinemas as opposed to TV. The original series has a fantastic cast: Derek Jacobi, Brian Blessed, John Hurt plays a very sickly, creepy-looking Claudius. Patrick Stewart's in it. John Hurt plays Caligula. Patrick Stewart, John Rhys Davies, so you got Captain Picard and Gimli, right?
Right.
It is, I will say, even as much as I enjoyed the story, I had a hard time watching it because it is very 1970s BBC. Shot on very poor quality video, very, very stagey. I mean, it's basically a stage play on video. So, you know, caveat emptor. I would second the nomination for Gladiator, and I think it's interesting. You know, it kind of sheds some light on the modern perception of Marcus Aurelius to look at the actors who've been chosen to play him. The guy in Gladiator is Richard Harris, who also was the original Dumbledore. So you've got this kind of, you know, wise old man figure. Another movie I'd recommend that has a revealing choice of actor to play Marcus Aurelius is The Fall of the Roman Empire, in which Alec Guinness plays Marcus Aurelius. So you've got Dumbledore and Obi-Wan Kenobi playing him, which again, I think says something about his reputation.
Well, so they play opposite each other in the movie Cromwell.
That's right. Oh,
so,
weird. Okay.
Yeah, if you want to see Obi-Wan Kenobi fight Dumbledore, that's your go-to.
Oh man, my brain just melted a little bit. Anyway, Fall of the Roman Empire is about as historically reliable as Gladiator is. It's actually got an extremely similar story about a trusted general of Marcus Aurelius who is going to be made the next emperor until Commodus kills Marcus Aurelius and makes himself emperor. And they've also got to vie for the affections of Sophia Loren. who is wearing her best 1960s makeup. It's really over the top. It's one of those 60s epics that kind of bankrupted the genre because it went so over budget. But it is a lot of fun to look at. And one thing I appreciate about it is that in addition to some pretty good performances, really young Christopher Plummer plays Commodus. They built a full-scale, point-by-point set of the entire Roman Forum. That was not just facades. It was, you know, every building you could actually go into and use for its original purpose, which, you know, having actual sets makes a difference. Just watch the Star Wars prequels. Fall of the Roman Empire, I, Claudius, Gladiator. Two pieces of fiction I would recommend, both of which have film adaptations. No, wait, one of them doesn't. Pompeii by a British writer named... Robert Harris. Read it back in the spring, and it's one of the best novels I've read in a while. Really, really gripping. There is a movie called Pompeii, which I have not seen, but is not based on it, and is apparently kind of a B-movie. The other one is The Eagle of the Ninth, which is kind of a young adult novel by Rosemary Sutcliffe. It's set in Roman Britain, and it is a really nice dramatic way of looking at some of the tensions in a far-flung province that we've been talking about. There's a film adaptation called The Eagle that has Donald Sutherland, Channing Tatum, and Jamie Bell in it. It's been a while since I've watched it all the way through, but it's got some really great Roman army scenes at the beginning of it especially, so I'd throw that in there too.
Yeah, and these will come up again when we get to Christianity. There's, like you said, that whole 60s era of better or worse quality movies made that are set during that Julio-Claudian time. So The Robe, the guy who plays Caligula is fantastic. Even the guy who plays Tiberius does a decent job. A movie called Quo Vadis. I've not seen all of it. I've only seen the selections with Peter Ustinov as Nero, just chewing up the scenery.
Peter Ustinov is great.
Oh, it's really, really well done. It takes a definite interpretation of Nero and runs with it, but they run really well.
So
Quo Vadis, The Robe. I'm trying to think of others of those 60 movies. There's so many of them, and most of them are just terrible.
There is a 1980s miniseries called Masada, which deals with some of the aftermath of the Jewish revolt. I haven't seen the whole thing, but what I have seen is pretty good.
Right. And there are several movies made about that. So we can talk more about that. I was thinking we might do, as our lead into Christianity, sort of a bit on Judaism, since it's so relevant. I think that's all I've got off the top of my head. Anything to add? Otherwise, we should wrap up this extremely long episode.
That's all I can think of. I'm a little emperored out, so I'm going to go put those spots back on my daughter and get some free lunch.
No, I think that's a great idea. All right. Well, with that, thank you for indulging us in this longish episode through the emperors. We will have another one coming up one of these days. The City of Man is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippic. Please check out the other podcasts in their family and get more information about our own show or our show notes by visiting ChristianHumanist.org. Please do leave us a review on iTunes and like our Facebook page at Facebook.com/City of Man Podcast. You can also email us at CityofManPodcast@gmail.com. This is Coyle Neal. On behalf of Edward Song and Jordan Poss, let me remind you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and render unto God those things that are God's.